I will ask Brother David Bruce to ask a blessing on Brother Ike's service. Our loving and eternal Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy holy and righteous name. Reverently, in the name of Jesus, we approach thy heavenly throne of grace, thankful for our many blessings, thankful for this opportunity that we have of meeting together here in this place to hear thy word expounded to us, to hear that which will bring comfort and peace and joy to our hearts as we contemplate thy promises to us and all of mankind. Now we pray, dear Father, thou be in our midst to bless us. Help us to rid ourselves of all anxious thoughts. Help us to pay attention to what is being said, that we might learn that which would be a blessing to us and informative to our hearts and minds as to what thy plans and purposes are. And we pray that thy special blessing will be with our brother George Yike as he ministers to us, that as he ministers to us, he himself may be strengthened in the faith that has kept us all so far in this narrow walk that we have chosen to walk. And now we leave all in thy care and keeping, praying for thy kingdom to come soon. In Jesus' dear name, amen.
Thank you, Brother David. Brother Yike has chosen for his subject this evening, Why Does God Permit Evil? Why does God permit evil? We were told to announce that the Boise class holds regular meetings on Sundays as well as midweek meetings. And you know, and if you wanted to contact the Boise class to attend one of their meetings or to get some literature from them, contact them through the Boise Bible Students, Post Office Box 8911. And if there are any questions at the end of the meeting, please feel free to ask somebody in the Boise class or at the book table, and somebody will surely help you with your questions. We are also reminded of the announcement of the ice cream social after this service, and there are maps on the table to direct us there. Also, there are booklets on the table. The pamphlets are for free. And there's also the booklet on the subject that will be spoke of tonight. This time I'd like to introduce Brother Yike.
Why does God permit evil? Certainly not a new question, is it? It's a very prevalent question, as a matter of fact. Well, we perhaps don't hear it uttered too often, but it's pretty much a silent question in the hearts of millions upon millions of people, especially in our time when evil seems so prevalent. It seems so prevalent because it's piped into our homes. Every night when we sit and look at the news, we ask ourselves pretty much the same question, don't we? The news is filled up with the evil that's going on in the world and in some manner or another. And we say, how long, O Lord? How long? Why do you permit these things? Why were they permitted in the beginning? It's a question that is no doubt asked more often during great times of stress, during times of war. when literally hundreds of thousands die as a result of the onslaught of war, men, women, children, people who are striving to live righteous lives as well as people who are wicked, seems to be very indiscriminate, doesn't it, as far as the actions of evil in this world towards either the righteous or the wicked. The question is often raised when a very small child dies, an innocent child. We say, well, why would God allow an innocent child to die? Almost as if God was punishing it for no reason at all. If we turned on our televisions, if they had televisions 500 years ago, we probably would have seen a different set of news, wouldn't we? But it would have been just as filled up with problems of the world, the evil that's in the world, the heartache, the suffering, sickness, calamities, war. We might have tuned in on pictures of the Norman invasion of England. I'm sure to the people at that time it was just as calamitous as anything that's happening in the world today. Or maybe when Genghis Khan with his hordes overswept Europe and just left a trail of bloodshed and devastation behind him. Or the French Revolution, or the American Revolution, or the Civil War, for that matter, to bring it more up to date. In other words, the world has always experienced evil throughout their history. We don't have a time, can't point to a time in history when the world has not had trouble. There are many who attempt to rationalize on this and to somehow justify God in all of this. And some of them say, well, God has a right to do what he wants. Well, of course he does. But it's not the kind of God that the Bible presents to us who would glory in these kind of circumstances on earth among his children, his earthly children. Some say, well, maybe God just doesn't care. It's not a very good answer either, is it? Not a very satisfactory answer, because it implies that if God doesn't care now, he's not going to care 1,000 years in the future or 5,000 years in the future, that these conditions will just continue to prevail. Some say, well, maybe it's out of hand. Maybe God can't control it. Well, he's given a certain proofs in the Bible that he can control it. There was another world spoken of in the Bible, the world before the flood. And God looked down upon that world and saw the great evil that was in it, how sinful man had become. And he had the power to end that situation, didn't he? He destroyed civilization, destroyed humanity at that time except for 8 souls. I'm sure that we wouldn't want God to deal with our present generation in the same way, to rid it of evil and sin. And doing that didn't rid the world of evil and sin. It carried over into our world. It's come down to us today. And there are others who perhaps feel it and express the thought from time to time that this is natural, that God made the world. Evil is always present. It's always going to be there and express itself, and that death is just a normal consequence of the way God made our world, and that it will always continue this way. These are not really very satisfactory questions or answers to this question, are they? And so it's an age-old question. It's a question that even the Bible asks. And wouldn't you expect that God in his word would deal with this question? naturally, and when he deals with it, why, he gives us satisfactory answers, reasonable answers. Yet the question is asked, for instance, in the book of Habakkuk. And there we find a prophecy. When we consider all the detail in the prophecy, we find that it's a prophecy projected down to our day and pretty much describing some of the evil conditions that exist in the world today. And we find there a world that is being invaded by what are referred to as terrible and dreadful enemies. And the world that is pictured here is pretty much the Christian world. And when they look at the circumstances coming upon them that is more or less undermining the whole foundations of Christendom, they have this to say, the first chapter, second verse, "O Lord, how long shall I cry and thou wilt not hear?" It seems like that's happening, doesn't it? The world, the Christian world, has prayed to the Lord for centuries to end the suffering in the world, to do something about it, in the hope that they would, somehow or other, he would empower them to set up Christ's kingdom on the earth, and Christ's kingdom would put down all the wrongs and the ills of the world. But apparently he hasn't heard. "How long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? Even cry unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save." That's how the untrained in the world would view the situation. But God is unconcerned about these pleas. Why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention. Well, this pretty much describes the turmoil of our world today. "Therefore the law is slacked, and judgment doth never go forth. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceedeth." And then he goes on throughout this prophecy to describe why the world is looking at this situation, wondering why God doesn't do something about it. And of course, what we find described here is the great threat that exists to the Christian world today by, we might say, the upsurge of socialistic reform and thought through the world, particularly in the Eastern world, which is pretty much the based upon the foundation of atheism and what we'd refer to today as the communist world, is a great threat to the total destruction of Christian thought. And this is what this prophecy is describing. It goes on in the 13th verse to, they're pleading with God. They're trying to tell God that he's too good a God to allow this to happen. "Thou art pure of pure eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devour the man that is more righteous than he?" You know, the world, even Christian world, really doesn't have an answer for this. We couldn't expect that they would. But the prophecy ends on a brighter note because it goes on. It's a short prophecy, and in the third chapter of the book of Habakkuk, it tells us about the time when God will exert his great power over the earth. And this is all very symbolic language, too. But we can read in it hope for the future, that God will end these problems and these troubles and the evil that is on the earth. And it's really quite a thrilling part of the prophecy to read. It talks about God reviving his work in the midst of the years. You know, God had a purpose for this earth in the beginning, and we're going to discuss that as it was represented in his first creation, Adam. And yet that was cut off. And it's ever since that time where the world has been in the throes of the principles of unrighteousness, because they've been influenced by the great adversary, Satan. And yet, he speaks here of a time that when God is going to revive his work that he started way back there, in the midst of the years, in the midst of the years, make known, in wrath, remember mercy. Another prophecy, or the apostle Paul, it is, tells us that what man has been experiencing in the permission of evil has been an expression of God's wrath. Not wrath against humankind, but it allows him to give expression to his wrath towards all unrighteousness because of the conditions that unrighteousness creates or causes. And that it's that which it's important that the human family learn and understand before they can really appreciate God. And so this prophecy goes on to tell us that there is a time when God is going to take action. It's all pre-planned and in advance. And while it might seem long to us, that it's not necessarily long from God, from the standpoint of God's plan for the permission of evil and for the time, stated time in which he will allow it to exist, and only during that time. And he says here in the sixth verse, he said, he stood and measured the earth, indicating that he's still in control. Even though it might appear that he's not, everything's out of control, he's still in control. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, those that were perpetuating these circumstances of evil upon the earth. And the everlasting mountains were scattered, nations of this world, and the governments of this world, and the social structure of this world is thought in terms of perpetuating themselves. It's hard for any government to ever visualize themselves ever coming to an end. It's hard for people living under those governments. It's hard for us to appreciate the idea or to understand the idea that our government would ever come to an end. And yet this prophecy says that these that considered themselves to be everlasting mountains, which is a symbol of governments and kingdoms in Bible language, he says that the Lord scattered them. And the perpetual hills, even all the lower structure of a social order of things, they did bow. They were brought into conformity to the great power that the Lord was exerting on the situation, because his ways are everlasting, and the earth that he will establish eventually will be everlasting. Malachi makes a comparison and in essence asks the same question: why does God permit evil? By observing the conditions of his day. This was sometime before the time of Christ. 15th verse of the third chapter, he says, "Now we call the proud happy, and they that work wickedness are set up, and they that tempt God are even delivered." But those who are the wicked of this world, and those who are the proud and that work wickedness, that they seem to be the ones who flourish and the ones that more or less set the standards for this world to a great extent. But he tells us also, as we go on in this prophecy, that isn't going to be forever. There's going to be a time when the Lord will set up his arrangements on the earth. And here's just an expression out of the end of this prophecy where he describes some of this. He talks about a return. Of course, he's particularly talking about the nation of Israel coming back into God's favor, but the prophecies tell us that when that happens, when Israel comes back into God's favor, that the world is going to be brought back in God's favor during the same period of time. "Then ye shall return and discern between the righteous and the wicked." Better translation says, be able to discern between righteousness and wickedness. That's what they weren't able to do before. He called the proud happy, and they that work wickedness are set up. But there will come a time when the world will be able to discern, properly discern, between righteousness and wickedness, between him that serveth God and between him that serveth him not. And he says, and when that time comes, then all evil and wickedness is going to be trodden down like ashes under the soles of your feet. Here again it seems to refer to the wicked, but the better translation is wickedness, or the principles of wickedness will be trodden down. And it's indicating that the people themselves will have a responsibility to do that. God will show them the way. He'll set up the organization for it, but the people themselves in that day will have the ability, through greater discernment, to tread down wickedness. It shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. The Lord wanted to emphasize and in some way demonstrate why he permits evil. And he used the whole book of the Bible to do it very effectively. He picked a very righteous man to make this demonstration with, and to express this lesson. Man's name was Job. Now the Bible tells us that Job was a very wealthy man by the standards of his day. Most of their wealth was measured in what they owned, in their material wealth. His material wealth was great, in herds and flocks of all kinds. And he owned a fine home, I'm sure, and had a large family, sons and daughters. And it says that one day Satan challenged God on this matter. God was, of course, probably pointing out Job, what a faithful servant he was to God. He was a righteous man and faithful to God, and tried to be faithful to the principles of God, probably as much so as anyone who was under the fall could. And he told the Lord, he said, you know, he says, the only reason that he obeys and serves you is because it's expedient for him. He says, you bless him when he does. But if you take away all of the hedges that you've put around him, his wealth and his family and all of that, he says, why, he'll curse you to your face. So the Lord said to Satan, he says, well, we'll see about that. He says, I have greater faith in the integrity of Job than that. And he says, it gave Satan, or permitted Satan. That's the reason we like to use this word, why God permitted evil. He didn't do it himself, even though God took the responsibility for allowing it to happen, as we see a little later in this one of the statements in this prophecy. But he allowed Satan to take away all of Job's earthly possessions. In quick succession, they were taken away. There was one of his servants came and told him that, first of all, that I'm not just sure about the order, but I think that his oxen and his asses were all destroyed. And then he says that lightning had struck his sheep and destroyed them all. Fire came down from heaven and fell upon his sheep. And his camels were all killed. The Chaldeans came and destroyed them. The Sabaeans came fell upon his servants and killed them and took many of them away and so on. And yet, in spite of all of this calamity, Job maintained his integrity before God. God was vindicated through the integrity of Job up to this point. And it says that after Job had all of this taken away, Why, the statement that he made was, he says, well, I didn't have any of it when I was born. Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. That when the Lord, when his life was over, he wouldn't have any of these things anyway. He'd leave them to others. The Lord gave, and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all of this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. Well, the adversary wasn't content with this. And so he went back to the Lord, and he says, well, he says, the test wasn't strong enough. He says, if we took away Job's family and his wife, and it says, if we hurt him physically, he says, then he'd turn from you. And so all of his family was taken away. His sons and daughters were killed. His wife, after Job, he got boils all over from head to foot. He was in terrible pain, very much in discomfort. And finally, he didn't even have a home to live in anymore. And he went out and tried to make himself as comfortable as he could in a pile of ashes, which is probably the way they medicated for boils in those days. And he was a pitiful sight. His wife came along and saw him like this, and she said, why? She says, the Lord's punishing you for it. And he denied that and said that he didn't think the Lord was punishing him for it, that he had not sinned, that he was a righteous man by the standards of his life. And she just turned away from him and told him to curse God and die. But he wouldn't curse God. So Job sat there. And it wasn't long before his friends heard about the terrible plight of Job. He'd lost everything. There's one statement here that says he was the richest man in the East, and he lost everything. So three of his friends came, and they just couldn't believe it. They could hardly recognize Job. And here he was sitting in that pile of ashes, and they felt so sorry for him and were so sympathetic that all they could do was sit there for 7 days without saying a word. And then the book of Job goes on and gives us a very, very detailed account of the conversation that went on between Job and these three comforters. And all of it had to do with more or less the philosophy of why Job was suffering like this. And they were trying to tell Job that it was because he had had some big secret sin in his life that he wouldn't even admit to, and that God was punishing him for it. And Job knew that that wasn't true, and of course he wouldn't admit to it. And so the bulk of the chapters of Job deal with this conversation that went on. You know, this isn't too unlike, and God was trying to depict here in the person of Job the plight of the human family. Of course, we become more aware of this when we get into the end features of this story, which we will do briefly. But not too unlike the plight of the human family as they were represented in Adam. Here he's showing how the human family since is represented in Job, in the life of Job and in the personage of Job. But the human family was also, in the beginning, represented in Adam, weren't they? And Adam was the richest man in the East. Richest man in the world. And he was going to pass those riches on to all of his family. He had life. He was a perfect human being. He was not under any sentence of death at the time. That came later. He had dominion. He had the substance of the world. Let him make man after our image. He was made in the image and likeness of God. What a great, valuable possession that is. Of course, the book of Genesis makes the contrast between this great possession which mankind had, which the lower animals had, did not have, and which denied them the right and the ability to exercise the dominion of earth. But man was made in the image of God. He was made with the ability to reason, made with the ability to love, and made with the ability to exercise patience and mercy, and also the great ability to carry out God's purposes for creating, finishing a perfect earth. Let us make man in our image and after our likeness, and let him have dominion over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth, over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. May he get much richer than that. And he's going to share all of that with his posterity. But like Job, it was all taken away very quickly. When Adam sinned, God brought him under the condemnation of death and drove him out from the Garden of Eden and from his dominion. And we say, well, what purpose did that serve? Well, it's kind of interesting that right from the very beginning, God expressed the purpose in the Garden of Eden. He told about all of the wonderful trees and all the wonderful provisions that he had made for man there and all the green herbs that were good for food for man and beast in the Garden of Eden. But there was one tree there that he specifically pointed out. Most of them referred to as the trees of life. It was one that might singly have been referred to as the tree of life. But there was also one which was referred to as the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he was denied the fruit of that tree. God gave him a simple law that he could not eat of the fruit of that tree. In the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Now why did he call it the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? It was, you say, well, why did he put it there in the first place? Well, it probably was just demonstrating the fact that evil as a principle always exists. It's the antonym of good and of righteousness, isn't it? It always is there to be acted upon. And it's the responsibility of his intelligent creatures to be able to discern between good and evil, between wickedness and righteousness, and to choose righteousness. They have the ability to do that. Well, that was part of being created in the image of God, wasn't it? And so it was just being realistic about the fact that that exists. Also, there was represented there the fact that obedience to righteousness would bring life. All of the provisions for life and life abundantly and life continuously were there in the Garden of Eden. And as the human race population of the earth began to expand, it would have expanded also until eventually the whole earth, the whole world would have been filled with its abundance for the continued life of the human race. The only thing that would stand in the way of that would be disobedience. Disobedience to God's law of righteousness. And that's what this tree represented. And it was not long. Matter of fact, it was a relatively very short time before a situation existed, of course, with the adversary's help. He entered into the situation there in Job too, didn't he? He was very active as far as trying to effect the situation that would express this challenge to God, that if you take away all their blessings, why, they'll curse you to your face. And so, through Mother Eve, why, he induced Adam to disobey. Adam knew what he was doing. And he ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Well, you know, Adam, the fact that it was called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil Didn't mean anything to Adam, did it? All he knew was good. That's all he'd ever experienced. As a matter of fact, as far as we know, all of the angelic hosts, as observers of the situation, that's all they ever knew. There's, in the Bible record, there's no indication that any disobedience to the principles of God and righteousness had ever been expressed before. The adversary was conjuring them up in his heart and expressing them in his desires to deceive the human family. After they had sinned, God said this, "And the Lord said, Behold, the man has become as one of us to know good and evil." Well, I doubt at that point that they really knew the difference between good and evil, except that they had experienced some of the effects of evil, some of the effects of a seared conscience, as it were, by how they deported themselves and trying to clothe their nakedness and so on. But in effect, what the Lord was saying here is more or less prophetic of the fact that as a result of this act, they would learn to be able to know or to discern between good and evil, because how can you discern between the two until you've experienced it? How could they know evil until they'd experienced evil? And this was the start of the downward course of the human race in evil, into evil. And, of course, he didn't desire that they would continue to live under these circumstances except for the purpose of experiencing them. And so the sentence of death was expressed in the fact that he took away all of the other life-giving elements from the Garden of Eden. Lest he put forth his hand and take of the tree of life and live forever. And so we see that there is a correlation between the experience of the human family as they were represented in Adam and the experience of the human family as it was demonstrated and as they were represented in the life of Job, the experience of Job. Now the Apostle Paul, of course, builds on this, and he tells us that it wasn't just for Adam's experience that this happened, that death plagues all of mankind, that the sentence was upon all of the race because all of them were still unborn in the loins of Adam at the time that he was condemned. The Apostle Paul in Romans says, by one man's sin, death entered into the world. That isn't exactly the way it goes. I'll read it to you more accurately. It's Romans 5:12. Wherefore, by one man, sin entered into the world, and death by sin. And so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. And so it was God's purpose that this coming to a knowledge of good and evil would be the experience of everyone that would come forth upon the earth. And he tells us, of course, how quickly man fell into the throes of sin earlier in Romans 1:28. He says, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to reprobate minds to do those things which are not convenient. He says, God gave them over to these things. He didn't force them into it, but he knew what the common result would be if he allowed it to go on. And so he didn't. What he's saying is that he didn't stand in the way, that he didn't put any restraints upon this as far as the human family were concerned. And there were actually no restraints as far as how it would affect the human race. And that's one of the questions we have today, isn't it? That many ask, why do the righteous suffer along with the wicked? God made no provision for judging all of these matters and trying to bless the righteous more than and punish the wicked. He just allowed sin to take its course without any restraints upon how it would progress, except for those points in time when he desired that new lessons would be learned. Of course, at the time of the flood, the point had been made as far as his allowing sin before that time, and so he changed the situation and allowed the human race to take a different tack, and further lessons were learned, vital lessons that were learned in this matter of discerning between righteousness and wickedness. And so there were no real restraints. God did intervene. He intervened some 4,000 years after it all began. And the Apostle Paul tells us in Hebrews what constituted that intervention. He quotes from a prophecy or statement that was made by the psalmist in the 8th Psalm. What is man that thou art mindful of him? Referring back to man in the Garden of Eden, to Adam and Eve, he says, what is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou visitest him? He says, thou madest him a little lower than the angels, thou crownedest him with glory and honor, and didst set him over the works of thy hands. And that's what we read in Genesis, wasn't it? That was a statement of God's great blessing and great wealth that he gave to mankind. He gave him dominion and honor and glory as a perfect human being. He says, thou hast put all things in subjection under his feet, for in that he put all things in subjection under him, he left nothing that was not put under him. But he says, in a very realistic way, he says, but we see not yet all things put under him. Sin intervened. God, man could not exercise their dominion except under, as they were controlled under the principles of righteousness, except as they maintained their integrity before God, that they could not exercise that dominion. They lost it. He says, but we see Jesus. This was how God intervened in the affairs of men, so that eventually this downward course of man, when the lesson was learned, it could be altered, could be changed. And it required a ransom on the part of Adam. And because all of the human race were in the loins of Adam at the time that he sinned, and the race and the sentence was pronounced, it would only require one ransomer, who himself would have to be made a little lower than the angels, perfect in his being, who would have to die in the place of Adam. And thus it is the benefits of this corresponding price or ransom could be made available to all of mankind, since in Adam all died. He says, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, just like Adam was in the beginning, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor. He was crowned with the glory and honor of human perfection. And the psalm said that about Adam, didn't it? He says that he was crowned with glory and honor. Oh, a perfect human being is a wonderful agent of God. He was given dominion, and a dominion, in a sense, expresses rulership, doesn't it? And so he had a crown, but it was a glorious crown. It was an honorable crown. It was a crown that allowed him, as long as he wore it, to govern his dominion in righteousness. It was a crown that represented the image of God, wasn't it? And the authority of God placed over him, in him. A little lower than the angels, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. And so it is that with this intervention comes the hope for the future. And it's the hope of the Bible, isn't it? That hope was expressed in the life of Job. What we read was not the end of the tale of Job's life. In the 38th chapter of Job, after all of his comforters had failed to convince him, and they had used all kind of philosophy to try to explain his situation and how true that is with the world. Down through the course of ages, the philosophers had tried to explain why man is suffering the way they are, why we have wars, why we have all the trouble and disease and sickness and all of the calamities that happen to man, why we have them. They've tried to philosophize on them. And most of them have come up with the idea that it's a punishment of some sort, or it's a world that is normal and natural and we're born into it, and that we can be saved out of it if we simply want to just say we believe, without really expending very much more initiative than that. But this all came to an end. It's all going to come to an end as far as the world is concerned. It came to an end when the Lord spoke to Job. He spoke to him out of a whirlwind. And he had some interesting things to say to Job, things that Job didn't understand or couldn't answer. And that's what he was trying to point out. He asked Job a lot of very intricate questions about creation and about phenomena of life on this earth and so on. And the point of it all was that how could Job really understand the matter of wickedness and evil unless he had experienced it? That there were a lot of things about God that he didn't understand, and that he should have faith in God that these things concerning his condition could be made understandable to him, and that the Lord hadn't rejected him, but that it was serving a very important lesson in his life. And so after Job began to understand this, and then he made a statement, he says, "Behold, I am vile." And the word vile there has a thought of acting quickly. He says that I've said a lot of things very hastily that I really didn't understand. And the world has said a lot of things very hastily that they really didn't understand. He says, "What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yea, twice, but I will proceed no further." And so after Job had come around into the right attitude of heart to learn and to be instructed by God, why then it was that he began to really understand and see God in all of his glory. He made this statement. He says, before, "I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear," and he had heard of him, and it made an impact on his life. He had tried to live a righteous life before God. But he says, "Now that I've gone through this experience and I understand what the evil can lead to, and I've been able to make a contrast between the conditions, these conditions, and the conditions of the righteous," he says, "Now my eye seeth thee." And of course, here again, he was still expressing what the world will come to see and understand and appreciate about God when they can see God, when they will have a better vision, a more accurate understanding of their Creator and their relationship to Him. In Micah, the 4th chapter, is another prophecy that tells us about that time. Refers to it in the pictorial symbolism of a kingdom, doesn't it? A mountain. And it says that it'd be in the latter time, in the last day, which in the general definition of it means at a later time. It wasn't time yet in Micah's day for this to happen. But in a later time it shall come to pass that the mountain of the Lord's house, now here's another expression using the symbolism of a mountain, which is talking about God's kingdom, or the kingdom of his house, which we know is, of course, Christ's kingdom, that it will be established. It will be established in the tops of the mountains over all of the governments of this world, and that these governments will give way to it because the people that are in them will flow into the one kingdom concept. And then he goes on to say how that is going to change their lives, that when they come to learn of his laws, because they go up, it says, to Jerusalem, to the mountain of the Lord's, of the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he teaches them of his ways, and they walk in his paths. When they learn of his law, which will go forth out of Zion, the heavenly phase of the kingdom, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, well, it's going to change their lives completely. And they'll be able, through this general education of that time, to come to see God. They've only heard of him by the hearing of the ear up to that point. And it says that as a result of that, that they'll learn war no more. That they'll be glad to do away, and they'll have the ability to do away with a lot of these great evils that exist on the earth with the Lord's help. They'll be able to treat them as ashes under the soles of their feet. And he says they'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree. These are all symbolic expressions. But it's a representation of safety, of economic security. And that can only come when all of those things which threaten life and happiness, which are so rampant in the world today, are done away with. And none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. In the 25th chapter of Isaiah is another expression of that mountain, another picture of that mountain, another expression of what it will accomplish in the earth. It says, and in this mountain, same reference to the Lord's kingdom, the Lord of hosts shall make unto the people a feast of fat things, a feast of wine on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wine on the lees well refined. And that's, in general, the sense of that is that they're going to be abundantly provided for. They're going to regain the value, all of the wonderful, valuable things that were lost when the sentence was pronounced. And he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all the people. That covering kept them from seeing God, didn't it? All they could do was hear of him by the hearing of the ear, and what they heard, they distorted. And cast over all the people, and the veil that is spread over all nations. He says that's going to be lifted. They're going to be able to see God in his clarity, in the principles of God in their clarity. And he will swallow up death in victory. The greatest evil that came upon man was sentence of death. And he says, that's going to be swallowed up in victory. The Lord God will wipe away tears from off all faces, and the rebuke of his people shall he take away from off all the earth, for the Lord has spoken it. Certainly an indication that the Lord's going to take a strong hand in that day. One other brief statement from another prophecy of that time, 35th chapter of Isaiah. It talks about the ransomed of the Lord. That's the whole world of mankind. All that were condemned in Adam are now referred to as the ransomed of the Lord. Shall return. Malachi talked about returning, didn't they? Here they are returning. And they shall come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. And they shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. The psalmist wrote through the inspiration of God, weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning.
Thank you very much for the for that lesson. I'd like to remind you that of the ice cream social again, in case we have forgotten. I'm sure we haven't. If there are no further announcements, Brother Ike has chosen for his closing hymn, 365. 365.